Here we begin here on the top of Kuf Amud Aleph, three lines down. Reish Lakish achvile dinora l'Rebbe Elazar. Reish Lakish showed a coin to Rebbe Elazar. As we learned yesterday, if a person is a baki, person is a professional money changer on the level of Danko v'Isur, who were the top of their field, didn't need to learn anything more, then they have an indemnification where they do not need to pay if they make a mistake. Otherwise, a person who sees a coin and makes a recommendation that the coin is acceptable, it's going to be going currency, and they are wrong, then they are responsible for that. Yesterday we saw the story with Rabbi Chia, who despite the fact that he was an expert, still paid the woman back, mifnim yishur tadin. So over here, Reish Lakish goes to Rabbi Elazar and asks him to look at the coin. Amar ma'al yahu, he said it's a fine coin. Amalei, chazi da'alach kasamchino. Know that I am relying on you. Amalei, kisamacht alai ma'adememra. Because you're relying on me, what are you trying to say? Because if you find out that the coin is no good, I will have to exchange it out, meaning that I'll be out of pocket because of the fact that I told you the wrong information. That you're the one who told me that this whole position, that you have to change out the coin when you give bad advice, when you are professionally consulted about these items, that you're on the hook, you said that's only according to Rabbi Meir, who has done dinei degarmi, because this is not direct damage, it's an indirect damage that happens over here. You didn't do direct physical damage to the item, you simply gave bad advice, or bad consultancy here, and that's why we're going to make you chayav, and that's only according to one who says da'in dinei degarmi, and that's Rabbi Meir. My lav Rabbi Meir velo sviralan kavatei. And my assumption was that you said this is Dat Rabbi Meir, Dat Yachid, and therefore we do not paskin this way. Amalei, lo, Rabbi Meir, v'svir lan kavate. Reish Lakish says, no, when I told you that it was Rabbi Meir, I meant it's Rabbi Meir who is dine dine de garmi, and we paskin like Rabbi Meir, that we are dine dine garmi, and that's why you are chayav. So the conversation is interesting over here, because the conversation between Reish Lakish and Rabbi Elazar indicates that the reason that the professional is chayav, or even the hedyot is chayav, when they misadvise someone with regards to a coin, is because of Shitat Rabbi Meir, the Dayin Dine de Garmi. Again, we saw this in yesterday's daf with the Machloket Amorim between Rabbo and a Meimar, and we paskin that we are Dayin Dine de Garmi. So based on that, the obligation of Rabbi Elazar to pay here is because we are Dain Dinei Degarmi. Despite that fact, Reish Lakish still said to Rabbi Elazar that I want you to know that I am relying on you. So why did Reish Lakish make that statement? Why was it important for Reish Lakish to tell Rabbi Elazar that he was relying on him? So some Rishonim, like the Balei HaTosafot over here say, Akate Havei Tzarech LeMigmar, Rabbi Elazar was not a professional on the level of Danko and Isur or Rabbi Chia. He was maybe in training or someone who was not at the top of his field. Because if he was at the top of his field, he wouldn't have to pay. And even Rabbi Chia, who did pay, only paid it because it was lifnim mishurat adin. So therefore, Tosfot concludes that even had Reish Lakish not made the statement that I am relying on you, he would have been responsible. Reish Lakish is just informing him of the fact that he will be liable, but that's not the reason he is liable. It's not because he specifically stated that you are liable, that he's liable. He was just telling him the facts now that because you are not a full-fledged expert, you are going to be on the hook if something goes wrong with this coin. So it was informative, but not normative. The statement, the fact that you are responsible for this coin. And therefore, Tosafot believes that your reliance on this individual is what generates the obligation, not the fact that you tell him that you are relying on him. On the other hand, the Tosafot over here quotes from the Rif, who says, "Katav dolam lo michayev ad shiomru lo," that the Rif believes that you need to tell him that he is responsible. So the Rif says, despite the fact that he wasn't a full-fledged expert, the only reason that he is chayav over here is because you made the statement. And you must inform the person that you are relying on them in order for them to be culpable in these cases. Now, in the modern day law, there's a concept called detrimental reliance, which is when an individual relies on the statement or the action of an individual, and then based on that, makes a reasonable assumption about what they said and goes ahead and does something or acts on that. So, for instance, someone gifts money or a house or a car to a particular individual, and it's reasonable for that individual to assume that they would get the gift, or that this person would gift them that item. Then they go ahead, based on that gift, and make a decision. Whether it is they take a job far away because they think they're going to get a car, they go ahead and spend on a vacation because they're going to get money from this individual, and then all of a sudden the individual says, oh, too bad, sorry, I'm not going to give you the gift. In the modern law, you can go to court and extract the money from the individual, not necessarily because they have a right under the law, but because in an equitable or the court of equity, we would say that this individual relied on information that was given to him and acted on that information. And he made a reasonable assumption, and therefore it's called detrimental reliance. You relied on that individual to your detriment, and therefore he is obligated. So there you have this implied reliance on the individual, and that obligates them. So that's what the Balei HaTosafot are suggesting, is that that reliance is automatic. By the fact that you consult with these experts, they know, or they should know, or it's reasonable to expect that you're going to rely on them to make a decision about the money that you're accepting in the coin. And therefore you do not have to make the explicit statement that we are relying on you, but that is a given or understood in this situation. On the other hand, the Rif believes that you have to make that statement clear that you are relying on them, and therefore they are on the hook. If you don't make that statement, then that's all they're doing. They're simply consulting. They're not expecting you necessarily to rely on you, on them. Maybe you're going to get a second, a third opinion. They don't know that they are the person that you are relying on. And therefore the Rif demands that you make a statement or articulate the fact that you are relying on them. Others suggest over here that Rabbi Elazar was a hejot, which wouldn't make the din very different than what the situation is here, because a hejot is no different than a non-full expert, as we saw before. Others suggest that Rabbi Elazar was an expert on the level of Danko Isur and Rabbi Chia, and he would have been patur, he would have been exempt. And that's why Reish Lakish said to him, listen, I'm relying on you, and therefore you're going to be on the hook. Or basically, he took away what would have normally been the din here, which is the fact that he would have been exempt, and he would not have been responsible, and saying to him, despite that fact, the condition of my giving you this coin to look at is that you're going to be on the hook for it. And therefore he stipulated that would override this person's expertise, and he would be responsible if there was a problem with the coin. They have different views within the Rishonim as to why Reish Lakish had to make that statement, or whether it was even necessary at all, because of the fact that the real reason you're a chayav here is because of Rabbi Meir, which is that we are dying dine de garmi. Right, so the Gemara says, hey, Rabbi Meir, who or where is this Rabbi Meir that we know that he is dying dine de garmi? Ilema Rabbi Meir ditznan. If you think it's Rabbi Meir from the Mishnah that says, dan et adin, if a person adjudicates a situation, zikai et achayav, he exonerated someone who was otherwise culpable. Chiev et azakai, he made someone culpable who was otherwise innocent. Timei et atahor, he made something Tamei, when it should have been Tahor. Or Tiheret HaTamei, he said something was pure when it was really Tamei, it was defiled. Masha Asa Asui Vishalim Mi Beito. What is done, and he's got to pay out of pocket. So here you see, a judge is acting in his capacity as a judge, and he makes a mistake. Despite his making a mistake over here, and not being actively doing damage, meaning that he's not injuring anybody, he's not hurting anybody actively. Despite that fact, we make him responsible for the psak that he gave. And if he gave the wrong psak, he's got to pay out of pocket to rectify the situation. So that maybe is the proof that Rabbi Meir holds of dain din de garmi, because over here, this is garmi, that the judge caused the problem in the case and has to pay out of pocket, but it's not direct damage. So maybe this is the proof. Gemara rejects that as a proof because it says, Ha'itmar la, Amar Rabbi Eloah, we have said about that, that we qualify that Mishnah by the following statement of Rabbi Eloah, Amar Rav, v'hu shenatal v'natan biyad. That's only when the judge actively was involved in the case. What does that mean? Rashi brings examples in all of these situations. Number one is, for instance, if it was an outstanding loan situation, and he was mezakeh et achayav, he exonerated someone else who would have been guilty in this case. For instance, the mashkon of the loveh, the debtor's collateral, was sitting with the malveh, and the dayan took the mashkon from the malveh and handed it back to the loveh. The loveh was supposed to be chayav, was supposed to pay. He defaulted on the loan. The malveh should be entitled to the mashkon. The judge makes the wrong decision here, takes the mashkon from the creditor and hands it to the debtor. So that's how he's involved actively in the case. Or he took the money from the debtor and gave it to the creditor, meaning that he was an intermediary there. The money came from the debtor. He took that money and handed it to the creditor. In the case of Tuman Tara, if he is Tihere Tatameh, if he is Mitameh, something that was otherwise Tahor, to reinforce his position, he takes the sheretz and puts it on the fruits actively to show that it really is Tameh. Or the other way around, where he is Mitahere Tatameh, he thinks they were really Tameh, he makes them Tahor, he takes those and mixes them with the other guy's fruits to show that they're really Tahor. You don't have to worry about them, mixes them up. So in all of those cases, he was actively involved, meaning that he's a mazik biyadayim. And so you can't prove in that Mishnah anything about Dan Dinei Yerami, because the way that we qualify the Mishnah, it ends up being a mazik biyadayim. And that is noseh v'notein biyad. The Balei Tosafot over here discuss this, and he says, Ma ba'ile tuye mehochad Rabbi Meir, Dain Dinei Yerami. What is the hava mean of the Gemara that this case should be a case that proves that Rabbi Meir is Dan Dinei Yerami? And why does the Gemara set it up as a case where he actively was involved? Even if he did not actively get involved in the case, he is chayav, the judge here, even according to the Rabbanan. Delo dainai dine degarmi, who do not hold of dine degarmi. Kaven de ba'amira ba'alma kam dina. Because through his words, he creates the outcome of the case. The judge is responsible for his psak. And since his amira, since his statement, his psak halacha, is what determines the outcome of the din, he's already considered to be liable for his speech, or basically his amira is the ma'aseh. His statement is an action. And since his statement is an action, not only would Rabbi Meir say that you are chayav here, even the Rabbanim would agree that the Dayan is on the hook over here. And forget about getting involved physically in the case. Even if you don't get involved in the case at all, through your Amira, you are responsible for the Psak Halacha that you gave. So Tosafot says, I don't understand, first of all, why the Gemara qualifies the Mishnah and says it was a case where they were physically involved. And number two is, why they'd even think it was a proof to Rabbi Meir when the Rabbanim would agree to the outcome in this case. All right, so Tosafot answers the question and says this, anytime there's a case that is comes to a verdict, and the din is put in place, that's like an action, and not grama, and you would be chayav, even according to the Rabbanan, meaning Tosfot accepts his question, the maskana, that that is the case. But in certain instances, you're able to reverse the case. So when are you on the hook? When are you out of pocket if you give the wrong psak halacha? Is in a case when you cannot reverse the situation that you paskened about. But in a case where you can reverse the situation, then you would not be on the hook. Kagon, mare dinar, if you show a coin to an expert, ukagon, tabidvar mishnah. According to someone who makes a mistake, an egregious mistake, where it's an explicit Mishnah, over there we say that that mistake that Dayan's not on the hook for because it should be reversed. We should vacate the verdict because it's so obvious that the verdict is wrong because it's explicitly in a Mishnah. So in those cases, we would normally tell you to reverse the situation. So you are liable when you give the Psak Halacha, irrespective of whether you get involved physically, whether it was any maisa, your psak halacha is enough to obligate you both according to Rabbi Meir and according to the Chachamim. But what is the uniqueness of this case? That if he's nasav and notan biyad, then the Rabbi Meir chayav, or the Rabbanan patur, da vaday gromahu, mashe chilu achreikin, alpiv, o mashe ivru imperutav. Meaning that if the person himself afterwards takes action based on the verdict, so for instance, he gives a verdict that these items are tamei, so the guy goes in and puts a sheretz on top of him. He says, well, if they're tamei already, what does it matter? He puts a sheretz there. Or they paskin that they are tahor, and the guy goes, mixes it in with the rest of his fruits, and then finds out that they were really tamei. So in that case, there are two stages to the process. The first stage of the process is that the psak that was given. The psak that was given was wrong, and the individual technically should be liable for that psak. But in this scenario, the psak could be reversed. Meaning that you could do that without causing any damage or without difficulty. If you said it was tamei, and then you tell him that it was tahor, or if you told him that it was tahor, now you tell him it was tamei, you could reverse the verdict without any difficulty, without any problem. The issue is that in the interim, the party, the litigant that was here, went ahead and took action based on the verdict. When he takes action based on the verdict, that's already grama or garmi. That's already you caused a loss to this individual. Not directly, but indirectly. Your psak caused this individual to go ahead and take an action based on that. And that's why the Gemara thinks that this should be a proof to Rabbi Meir's Shita, because Rabbi Meir says, once the party or the litigant goes ahead and acts on your verdict, the Dayan is chayav for that. He is responsible for that, even though we could have reversed the verdict had the other person not taken any action. The Chachamim say you're a patur. The Baal HaBayit didn't have to go ahead and put a sheretz on it. He didn't have to go ahead and mix it with the rest of his fruits. If he just kept things the way they were, we could have undone the verdict. So therefore, the Dayan is off the hook based on that. Rabbi Meir says, no. If the Baal HaBayit takes action over here based on the verdict, that is dinei de garmi, and therefore you are chayav. And that's what the Gemara was trying to prove from this Mishnah. The answer of the Gemara is, well, you can't prove anything here because that Mishnah is qualified by the statement that he's nasam natan biyad, that he did it actively, he was physically involved. So it wasn't the Baal HaBayit who did the damage over here, it was the Dayan himself who did the damage, and that's why he's chayav over here, and that's why it's not a proof that Rabbi Meir holds of dinei de garmi. Had it been that it was the Baal HaBayit that did the action based on the verdict, that would have been garmi. But now that you're saying the judge acted on his own verdict, that's mazik biyadayim. That's no longer a din of grama or a din of garmi. So that's a big chiddush of the Baalei HaTosafot over here, that your psak halacha is enough to obligate you, and that the situation or the scenario here, or why the Gemara is bringing it down, is not because of the psak, but because of the outcome of the psak, or what someone does or acts upon that verdict. That is what creates the garmi or the grama over here. And then when we qualify the Mishnah and say it's the judge himself who's acting on his verdict, then you take it away from being garama or garmi and make it into mazik or activity of the judge himself. So Tosva then makes an interesting point at the end. He says, "Bitzarech iyun l'rabbonon, maishna depatri b'soreif shtarot chaveiro mitimei hatohor, v'kohanim shepiglu d'lo chashiv dinei de garmi." Tosfot says, according to what I'm saying now, that Amira generates an obligation, meaning that if you give a verdict or a wrong verdict, even according to the Chachamim, you are responsible as if you did it. It's a maaseh. How do you distinguish between a case where a guy goes and burns his friend's shtar, there we call it garmi, and the Chachamim say you are patur, versus someone who gives the wrong psak halacha, or kohanim who have the wrong thought or say the wrong thing about a korban and make it pigul, and there we obligate those individuals and say it's as if they did it or they were mazik biyadayim. Mali mazik ayidei sreifa. Mali mazik ayidei diburo. Why is there any difference if I burn the shtar or if I mazik through my words? You're telling me well, through my words I'm chayav. When I burn the shtar, I'm not chayav. So tzarech lomar, the dibur choshiv kemase. Dibur is like an action. Vavi mazik begufa mamon biyadayim. It's as if you're damaging the item biyadayim. Aval b'sereif shtar inu nugeya b'gufa mamon. You do not damage the item directly. Ni'ayra ba'alma hu dekali minei. The only thing you're doing is burning a piece of paper. Oh, the words, that which was on it, That's an indirect result of your burning of the paper. Ve'ein ela gram ba'alma. That's only causation. This is one of the qualifications that we mentioned that differentiates something from being grama to garmi, which is that in the case of the psak alocha, or in the case of the pigo of the kohanim, Tosfot says, that is like a maseh, because you are mazik beguf hamamon biyadayim. It's as if you are physically damaging the object itself. Whereas in the case of Sarev Shtar, you never are making physical contact with the item that you are damaging. The paper, yes, but the words on the paper or the intangible meaning of the contract or the bond that is written on the paper, there you don't directly contact or damage it. And that makes the difference between mazik v'yadayim versus a case of grama or garmi, which is that you are not physically in contact with the item that you are damaging. So now the Gemara tries to find another Tanaic proof to the fact that Rabbi Meir holds of Dan Dinei Garmi. Elohad the Rabbi Meir Ditznan, the Mishnah that we're going to see on the second half of today's daf. It's Baalo Adom. He hired him to dye it red. Utzvaal Shachor, and he made it black. Shachor hired him to make it black. Utzvaal Adom, and he made it red. Rabbi Meir Omer Notin Lo Dmei Tzamro, that he has to pay him for the wool, because he's deemed to be a gazlan, he's deemed to be a mazik over here, and therefore he's koneh, the item, by the shinui that he does. So now, over there, he's not doing anything actively biyadayim. He's not, quote-unquote, destroying the object biyadayim. He simply puts the wool into the cauldron, and then the cauldron has the dye take effect on the wool. Gemara here again says, hatam ka'avid biyadayim. There he's doing it actively with his hands. The question is, what was the Gemara's Havamina? Meaning, what did the Gemara think that he wasn't doing this directly? He puts the wool into the cauldron. Isn't that the classic case of Mazik Biyadayim, number one? And number two, it is the same answer that the Gemara gave before by the case of the judge. Nasav Natan Bayad was that he was actively involved. Over here, if he's actively involved, he's the one who puts the wool in the cauldron. What was the question that he's not a Mazik Biyadayim over here? So the Baalei Tosafot point out, again, this is another issue with regards to Garmi or Groma, which is that when one puts the wool into the cauldron, it does not immediately take the dye. It takes a day, 2 days, 3 days for the dye to take on the wool. There's a delay between the action that the person does and the damage that happens. That delay might be considered or classified as being grumma instead of direct damage. That's what Tosafot points out over here. Shom delomar de ein atzemer mishtane miyad kishnotein b'samamin deino kolet atzemer miyad ad bet yamim o gimel. Takes 2 or 3 days for it to take. V'grama ba'al mahu. In the end, the Gemara answers that it was biyadayim ka'ovid, that is still classified as biyadayim. It's not enough of a separation between your action and the delay that is there. But that's an important factor. Again, we mentioned this in the Rosh when we described about grama and grami, that one of the differences between grama and garmi was that grama involved some sort of delay between your action and the damage that happened. That delay, that tearing, causes it to be grama instead of either garmi or mazik biyadayim. And that's what Tosafot says. The Gemara's havamina here is the delay in the dye taking effect. But Gemara assumed maybe that makes it into grama or garmi rather than a mazik biyadayim. Gemara in the end concludes that's not the case, because as soon as he puts the wool in there, it starts to take the dye, and then it works over a time process, and therefore it's mazik biyadayim. But that's the thought process of why you would think this is possibly a case of grama or garmi. Say, la ah, Rabbi Meir, maybe it's this Rabbi Meir, ditnan. Hamasachech gafno agabi tfuato shel chaveiro. Someone who puts his grapevine on top of the grains of his friend, which would make it into kilea kerem. Harizek kidesh. You are responsible for making it into Kilei HaKerem, v'chayav, and you are responsible, again, you are culpable for that damage that you do when you put your vine on top of the grains of that individual. Gemara answers again, hotam nami ka'avid biyadayim. Also over there, he's doing a biyadayim. So again, Tosafot says, what's the Gemara thinking? We just, first of all, said that if you do a biyadayim, that you are chayav. Number two is, we said, even if there's a delay and it happening, it's still considered to be biyadayim here if it's directly correlated. So what's the chiddush here? So Tosafot says that in the case of no seven, no ten biyad, there he's actively involved and it happens immediately, the damage that is done. In the case of the yoreh, in the case where he's putting it into the cauldron to dye it, over there again, his action, his maseh b'yadayim, creates the resultant damage, even though there's a delay or some sort of tearing in the damage happening. Over here, you have one more step removed. Yes, he put the vine on the tevuah, but that doesn't make it kilei hakeren. The items have to grow then enough that they are now more than 1/200th that they grew together versus when they were separate. So not only do you have to do something, but then an exogenous variable has to then take place, which is the items have to grow by themselves. So now you have additional items. First of all, you do something and it has delayed effect. It only becomes a sur later on. And number two is that delay is not even correlated necessarily with your action, where the cauldron, when you put it in, that's what's going to happen. The dye is going to take in the item. Over here, when you put them together, they now have to grow in order for it to become a sur. So again, you would have thought maybe this is one more step removed, and that's considered to be garmi or grama. Again, the Gemara considers it and says, no, kavid b'yadayim, that's considered to be avid b'yadayim, and that's not a proof of grama or garmi. But here you see that Tosfot is trying to explain the chiddush in each of these cases or how they're differentiated from each other. Elaha Rabbi Meir. It's this Rabbi Meir that tells us that he is passing dinei de garmi. D'tanya, there is a braita. The truth is that it's a mishnah in kilayim, but Rabbi Meir's name is never mentioned in the Mishnah there. The reason to mention that Mishnah, we'll see in a second, the Rabbeinu Tam explains to us, because that tells us who the author of this braita is. Tanya, mechitza da kerem shenifritza. A wall in a vineyard that fell down. Omer lo gedor. Tell him, put it back up. Nifritza, if it falls down again. Omer lo gedor. Put it back up. Nitya ish mimena. If the guy gave up hope of him ever putting the wall up. The lo gadra, and he didn't fix it. Harizek hidesh. Then he makes it into kilei hakeren. V'chayav ba'achriyuto. And he's responsible for it. Now, who responsible party is? Whenever you have the kilei hakeren, it's the person whose vine is there that is responsible. The reason being that the requirement to distance yourself is really the obligation of the person planting the vine. If you have a wall between a vineyard and a field with grains in it, you could plant the vineyard all the way up to the wall and the grains up to the wall on the other side, because the wall itself creates the barrier and there's no kilei hakeren. Had there been no wall there, there would have been an obligation on the person who owns the vineyard to distance his vines away from the tevuah, arba amot, which is what's called kedei avudat hakeren. The amount of space that it takes to work the kerem, that would be the distance. So the party who is obligated here to make himself distant is the bala kerem. And since the bala kerem is the obligated party, if the wall falls down, we're going to make him the responsible party. So he is the one responsible to put the wall back up, or he's going to be the responsible party if kilei hakeren results here. And that's the last line in this braita, which is chayav achriuto, is the bal ha vineyard. The bala kerem is the one who is responsible here, because he's the one who's responsible to distance his vines away if there was no wall. So since the wall fell down and it's his obligation to distance him, if he doesn't put the wall back up, he is responsible. That's number one. Number two here is the wall fell down. When the wall falls down, we tell him, go and put it back up. Gedor, you have to warn him. Why do you have to warn him here? Why do you have to tell him to put the wall back up? Is there any value in warning him? So the Balei Tosafot note over here that if you warn him, then as long as he's engaged in putting up the wall, or he's responding to your warning, but please put the wall back up, even if the items grow during that period, they will not be deemed kilei hakeren. Basically, you're given a window of time to fix the problem. And even if they grow during that time period more than 1/200th of their growth, it will not become kilei hakeren as long as he's engaged in putting up the wall. Or, what the Mishnah says, he was not nityayesh mimena. The bala sadeh, the person who owned the grains, didn't give up hope that the bala kerem is going to put it up. So you warn him, and it seems that the bala kerem is engaged and is going to put it up. As long as that is the case, the items do not become kilei hakeren. As soon as you have him giving up hope about it, then it becomes kilei hakeren. That's what the braita says, that is kilei hakeren, because you've given up hope of him putting it up. Then once it grows 1/200th at that point in time, mean that it adds on 1/200th more of the growth that it had until then. Until then it was mutar. That extra 1/200th of growth will make it, because kilei hakeren is batel 200 to 1. So if you exceed that measurement of 1 to 200, then it becomes a sur, because then the plant has more iser in it than it has heter in it based on that ratio of 1 to 200. Next thing is that the Braita notes that he has to warn him twice. Because if he didn't warn him, then the Bala Kerem would not be responsible for the Kilei HaKerem that results, because he doesn't have to go out there and check the wall all the time. He didn't know it fell down. It was unbeknownst to him. He's not going to be responsible. So the Bala Seden needs to tell the Bala Kerem that the wall fell down. The Ri says, I have a safek here as to whether, what happens if it happens a third time? If it falls down a third time, do you need to warn the Bala Kerem again? Is it because the first time it falls down, okay, you warn him, he didn't know about it. The second time it falls down, he thought he fixed it, so now you have to warn him. But if already you warned him two times, and now it falls a third time, the guy should already know there's a problem with this wall, and he should be checking it. So maybe over there you don't need to warn him in the third time. The Ri is misafek, whether you have to warn him a third time or not, and whether it was in particular that it said it two times, or that it's just giving an example, two times, and the same would be the third time. You have to keep warning him in order for him to be liable for what happens. The Rabbeinu Tam has a different view over here, very interesting position with regards to why you need the warning. It says, Rabbeinu Tam Efresh, Da'achi Nachi Trei Zimne Lashminu Shim Yesh Tosefet Matayim Ben Masho Sif Kishnifrit Zarishona Benjamo Sif Nishtava Shnia Ein Mitztarfim Le'esor Da'kama Kama Betela. Rabbeinu Tam says that, say it grew 1/400th the first time the wall fell down, and then it grew 1/400th the next time the wall fell down. Together, that makes up 2/400ths or 1/200th. Maybe this should be Kilei HaKerem. What the Rabbeinu Tam says is by making these discrete events and warning them each time, it separates the events. And in separating the events, they will not be mitzareif. They will not join together to create a single shiur of isur. And that means after you warn him the first time and he fixes the wall, that fixing of the wall makes it that whatever Iser grew during that time period is now batel to the heter that was there. Then when you warn him again when the wall falls down, that's a separate incident. And since it's a separate incident, it will not be mitzaref. It will not be added to the previous incident. And it will be as if you're starting from scratch again. Everything's heter, and now you have to have 1/200th in order to be a sur. So what the Rabbeinu Tam says is that the warnings make these into discrete events. And in making them into discrete events, it means that they will not be added together to get to that shiur of 1/200th. And that's the reason behind why you have these warnings over here. Then Tosafot goes on to discuss the concept in general of what's kama kama batel, that when something drops in, is the first item batel, and then when the new item comes, you don't add them together, but you say there's heter. So for instance, in a case where you have a big pot of soup, and then a little drop of milk falls in there. It's less than 1/60th of the pot of soup there. Do we assume then that the milk that fell in, that drop that went in, is batel? The next drop of milk that goes in, is it falling into chicken soup without any milk in it? Or is it falling into chicken soup that had one drop, and this next drop will be added to the first drop? That's the concept of kama kama batel. So Tosafot wants to understand, when do we apply kama kama batel? And when do we say that they add together, or there's a concept called chozer v'neor, that the item that's sleeping comes back and arises. So Tosafot over here gives a basic distinction. Again, this is more for the Gemarot in Chulin and Avodah Zarah, but he makes a basic distinction here, which says that if there is a stop or break between the items, then we say kama kama batel. So if there's a continuous flow of an item, you don't say the first item that gets there is batel, and as each the flow continues, they're all batel. No, that's as if the whole thing got poured in there, and then you have to look at the entirety. If it was poured in, and there was a drop, and then it stopped, and then poured in, and stopped, and poured in, each drop that goes in has to be looked at independently, and therefore we would say kama kama batel. When we say chozer v'neor, when do we say that it reawakens? Again, that is more a subject for Chulin and Avodah Zarah, as to when we say that, maybe when it exceeds the rov. But there are different reasons or scenarios where it will be. But Tosafot here, in dealing with kama kama batel, based on this Rabbeinu Tam, says as long as you can separate between the events, there's a hefsek, that's enough to make it kama kama batel. And that's what the Rabbeinu Tam is saying. By making these events discrete, by warning him separately each time, that makes it that there was a hefsek between them. That allows the first growth to be batel, and then the second growth is a totally new event, and it's not mitzaref to the first event. So now, the only thing left we have to do is, the Gemara says, yeah, we found Dine de Garmi. Over here, the individual is a Shev Al Taseh. He's sitting at home, he doesn't put up a fence, And now he becomes liable for the grains that are ruined by this Kilei HaKerem over here. So here we have a classic case of Dinei DeGarmi, where your cause of the damage is from a passive action, meaning that you're sitting home and then you cause damage, and we make you liable, we make you responsible. Great, we found a case where it's Dinei DeGarmi and you're Chayav. Only problem is Rabbi Meir's name is never mentioned in this Braita. How do you know that this is the Shita of Rabbi Meir? So that's where the Rabbeinu Tam comes in and says, there is a Mishnah in Kilayim that has a Tana Kama who's unnamed, and then Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon who argue on the Tana Kama. A very similar Mishnah, not the exactly like our Braita, but a similar case. And over there, Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yossi say you are Patur, and the Tana Kama says you are Chayav. We know that Stam Mishnah is authored by Rabbi Meir. So therefore, what the Rabbeinu Tam says is, since the Mishnah in Kilayim, which is very similar to this Braita, is authored by Rabbi Meir, and we clearly see that Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon argue on that opinion, the only person that could be the author of this Braita is Rabbi Meir. And that's how the Gemara concludes, that this is the Shita of Rabbi Meir, even though he's not named in the Braita. And we don't say Stam Braita Rabbi Meir, that's only true by a Stam Mishnah. But since there's a Mishnah that is very similar to this Braita, and in that Mishnah, it's a Stam Mishnah, where the opinion of Rabbi Meir matches the opinion of the Braita, and the named Tanaim definitely argue, that's how we know that this is authored by Rabbi Meir, or this is the position of Rabbi Meir. And from here, the Gemara proves that Dinei DeGarmi is Chayav, according to Rabbi Meir, and that's the way that we paskin, that Dinei DeGarmi are Chayav, like Rabbi Meir, against Rabba's position, who said that we say that it is Patur. All right, now the next Mishnah. We've quoted this Mishnah a number of times already, which is, Anotein Semer Letzaba, person who gives wool to a dyer, Vigdicho Yoreh, and the cauldron burns it. Notein Lo Dmei Tzamro, he gives him the money for the Tzemer that he ruined, the wool that he ruined, he has to pay him for it. Over here, we assume it's because the cauldron was too hot. Since it was too hot, or it was not properly set up, that's what caused the burning of the tzemer. So he's responsible for the fact that he burnt the tzemer. Tzivao ka'ur. Now, ka'ur here is with an aleph. Although Rashi points out, it really means like with an ayin, which is k'mo ka'ur, which means that he made it bad. How did he make it bad? Is that he used the residual or the residue of the dye. He did not use the best or the quality dye. He had already used this many times or whatever was left over. He uses the residue in order to dye it. So he made a mistake because he used bad quality dye. And that's the problem here. And Rashi says, therefore, he's considered to be a mazik b'kavana. It's as if he has intent. Remember, all these are all key words to items that distinguish between something being, whether it's grama versus garmi, or grama versus mazik b'yadayim. We've seen these key words come up. One of them is kavana, intent to damage. Number two, we talk about no delay between the action and the outcome. Number three, we spoke about the fact that your action specifically infects the item that is damaged, not that you're doing something that results in something else being damaged. And also, we discussed the fact that it's got to be that it's you, Beguf, are doing the activity. So again, these key words come up. Rashi over here notes that this question of here, when he did it intentionally. Intentionally is because he used the wrong raw materials. And using the wrong raw materials, he knew that the outcome would be that you're going to get a bad quality outcome. That bad quality outcome you are responsible for. So now, that's the way Rashi describes it. The Rambam in the Perush Mishnayot says, Ka'ur shemar'ehu ra, that it looks bad. V'ushamar derech mashal zed tzaba'o adom, avahu ayin ra lo yikasher l'mashiratza'uto. Basically, he didn't get the color that he wanted. He did something wrong. Rashi talks about the raw materials being problematic. Here the Rambam talks about the outcome, that he gets a bad color, or he got the wrong color take. Even though he wanted it red, he got the wrong type of red or deepness of red, whatever it is. There was a mistake, but this is a mistake that's considered to be a mazik b'yadayim because he's actively doing whatever it is that he's doing, and he knows what the outcome is going to be based on the materials that he puts in here, and therefore he's considered to be a mazik b'yadayim. Therefore, if the benefit is greater than the outlays, he pays him the outlays. If the outlays are greater than the benefit, basically, because he's a mazik b'yadayim, he has the bottom hand here. The bottom hand means that he's only going to get paid out with the lower of his costs or the added value that he created over here? So the added value is clear. Once you had wool before that was white, now you have wool that is either colored. It may not be colored well, or as the Rashi says, he used poor quality dye. The Rambam says that he got the wrong exact color, but nevertheless, there is some sort of added value from going white to having the dye that goes. How much that benefit is, you can check in the market how much it will sell for now. So he created some additional value. The other thing is that he also has expenditures. There are two expenditures that are here. One set of expenditures is his salary, the labor that he put into it. The other expenditure is the raw materials that he puts in. Rashi in Baba Metzia says that the Yitziah here is the raw materials. Rashi here in the Tosafot speak about the Yitziah here being the labor that the person invested. So what the Mishnah is then saying is, if the labor costs or the raw material costs exceed the value he created in dyeing this wool, then you pay him the additional value of the wool, and he loses out on the costs because he created something that's worth less than the money invested in it, and therefore you pay him the lesser of those two items. If the shevach is greater than his outlays, then you pay him his outlays, and so therefore he gets reimbursed for his costs, but he's not going to be the beneficiary of the shevach, because ein uman koneh b'shevach li, especially here where he did the wrong thing, and therefore yado al hatachtona. So the next case is nitzba lo adom v'tzavao shachor. He hired him to make it red, and he made it black. Shachor v'tzavao adom. He hired him to make it black, and instead he made it red. Now here you have a machloket. Rabbi Meir omer notein lo dmei tzamro. Rabbi Meir says you pay him the wool. Rabbi Meir over here says that you're koneh with the shinoi. The shinoi that you do here, and again, he's considered to be a mazik biyadayim, and he's considered to be a gazlan, because he misappropriated the wool, and he put it into the wrong dye. By doing so, he makes a kinyan on it. Every gazlan is kushata gzela. Once he makes a kinyan on it, it's his. The wool is his. So the only thing he owes the balabayit now is to replace the wool that he stole. He doesn't have to pay him for anything else, whether it's damage or whether the shevach that is added here by the dyeing of the wool, the wrong color, but there's still value here. All of that accrues to the gazlan because he stole it and he has to pay the tzemer. That's Rabbi Meir's view. Rabbi Yehuda does not classify him as a gazlan. If the benefit or the additional value exceeds the costs, he pays the lower of those two, which is the cost. If the costs exceed the value that's created here, he gives him the benefit that was created because you pay the lower of the two. Now, according to Rabbi Huda, where he's not classified as a gazlan, and he's not necessarily a mazik b'yadayim, then why does he lose out over here? Why doesn't he get the benefit that he created, and the person should have to pay for that benefit? The answer is, kanis le lahai deshino. That Rabbi Huda was kones, this person, because he did the wrong thing. He didn't listen to the balabayit. So as a knas, we say, you're not going to get benefit from the shevach you created here, because you did the wrong thing for the balabayit. Now the balabayit's got to pay you for what you did wrong? No, we're going to penalize you, the one who did the wrong thing. And that's the knas is over here. And therefore, Yemirtze, and if you want, you choose. You pay the schar or the shevach, whichever one is lower. Or again, Rashi and Bava Metzia is the lower of the raw materials versus the benefit that's created. You pay the lower of those two because of a knas. The other thing is that you could argue that Rabbi Huda doesn't fundamentally disagree with Rabbi Meir, that there is a shinui over here. Maybe there is gezel. But the reason that we say that a person pays kishata gzela is because of takanata shavim. It's because we want the person to pay it back and not be stuck giving up all the shevach and all the benefit. That's only true when you're talking about a gazlan who steals it and then makes shevach. Over here, where the person was hired up front to do this, he's not a gazlan in the classic sense of a gazlan where you have to have a takanata shavim. Takanata shavim is not applicable over here. And for that reason, we're not going to say that the gazlan accrues the benefit, the shevach over here, because there's no need, or it doesn't make sense to put in place the takanat shavim over here. So that might be why, according to Rabbi Yehuda, the reason that he doesn't get the shevach is because of the fact that there's no reason to invoke takanat shavim over here. And as the Rambam notes here in the Perusha Mishnayot, the choice is up to the Bala Beged, which one he chooses. But those are the only choices available to him. He cannot say, give me back my wool and just pay me for the wool. I don't care about the shevach. I don't care about the itziah. And that is because, as the Rambam says in the Perusha Mishnayot, Hi takana lekol echad mishnehem. This takana is protective of both parties here. It's protective of the individual who gave over the item because he pays the lesser of those two items. It is protective of the uman so that he's not totally out the money and the guy can just say, take whatever it is and just give me my wool back. And the same is true in the reverse. The uman himself has no right to say to him, here's your wool back, you can't have whatever I made, or you can't be the beneficiary of that, because ein uman koneh b'shevachli. And so therefore the takana is really to the benefit of both parties, definitely favoring the balabayit, because the uman was at fault here, but still both parties are somewhat protected by this takana. Okay, now Gemara says, Maikor, what is this problematic or bad outcome? Amar Rav Nachman Amar Rav Chana, kalbos, my kalbos, Amar Rabba Bar Shmuel, Kafra Dode. It is, as Rashi says over here, Kineach et Yoreh. It's the residue or the residual of the dyes that is found on the edge of the cauldron. So basically, that's what Rashi explained to us on the Mishnah, that it's about a bad outcome because he used a low quality dyeing materials. And that's what is this Ka'ur that we have over here. Or as Rashi goes on to explain, it's like the Kinuach, it's like the rag that you use to wipe out the sides or the residue that is in the cauldron, and so that it gets colored by that residue, whether it gets multicolored because of all the dyes that were in there, or it just takes on a uneven or improper coloring because of the fact that it's just done from the wiping on the edge of the cauldron, or because you're using bad raw materials. Tanu Rabbanan, anotein etzim lecharash lasot mehem kisei. If you give wood to a carpenter to make a seat, a chair. Vasamein safsal, instead he makes a bench. Safsal, you gave him the wood to make a bench. Vasamein kisein, instead he made a chair. Rabbi Meir Omer, notein lo dmei etzav. Rabbi Meir, consistent with his position, says he is a gazlan. And therefore, as soon as he's a gazlan, he has to pay him back for the wood that he took. He doesn't have to deal with what he made with it. Rabbi Omer, ima shevach yeter al yitziah, notein lo et yitziah. Im yitziah yeter al shevach, notein lo et shevach. The same way that as our Mishnah, he gets the lower of the benefit created, or the outlays that he had over here. That is because we want to either, like Rashi says, a knas, we want to penalize the professional for doing the wrong thing, and say you're not going to benefit from doing the wrong thing over here, or to say that there's no reason for takanat ha-shavim over here, and there's no reason to grant the professional the shevach over here, because there's no takanat ha-shavim, and ein uman koneh b'shevach li. And so for both of those reasons, there's no reason that he should be the beneficiary of the shevach that is created over here. Umode Rabbi Meir, im natan etzim lecharash losot mehem kisei na'eh, v'asam mehem kisei ke'or, if he gave him wood to make a nice chair, and instead he made a poor chair, safsal na'eh, v'asas safsal ke'or, if he was supposed to make a good bench, he makes a bad bench, im ha-shevach yitel yitziah, noten lo dmei yitziah, yitziah yitera le-shevach, noten lo dmei ha-shevach. He agrees with Rabbi Yehuda over here that you get the lesser of the two, because in that case he didn't make a shinoi that was big enough to make him a gazlan to acquire the item. And since he didn't acquire the item, then he is not entitled to the shevach that's there as a gazlan. Okay, we're going to stop here on the top of Kuf Amud Aleph by the two dots.